Hey everyone, it's Jimmy Morris. Thanks for joining me for today's session. I'm going to start off by giving away a couple of free books. It's time to announce the winners for first, Stop Anxiety from Stopping You by Dr. Helen Odesky. This great resource is going to go to Chloe. Congratulations, Chloe. I know that you're going to enjoy this great resource by Dr. Helen Odesky. I interviewed Helen on a previous episode of Psych Sessions, and it's a great book. The next book that I'll be giving away is another good one by Dr. Bernard Golden, which is Overcoming Destructive Anger. Has some really practical insight in it. And the winner is Faye. Congratulations, Faye. You've won a copy of Dr. Golden's book, Overcoming Destructive Anger. So congratulations to both Chloe and Faye. I know that you guys will enjoy these resources, and I'm really happy that I'm able to provide them to you. All right, moving on with today's session. I've got a great topic, dialectical behavior therapy, and I've got a great guest, a subject matter expert in the field, Dr. Matthew Mandelbaum. Dr. Mandelbaum, thanks for joining me today and welcome to Psych Sessions.
Thank you. It's really great to be here.
Well, as we jump in, I invite you to share a little bit about your background, your education. How did you come to specialize in working with DBT?
My pleasure. I am practicing in New York City, offering DBT in New York City for professionals in business, healthcare, the arts and education, emerging adults and university students. And I was intensely trained in dialectical behavioral therapy as a first cohort member of the two-year Linehan Institute Behavioral Tech DBT team building intensive for independent practitioners. My PhD is from Fordham in educational psychology. And before that, I had master's from Bank Street College in general and special education and NYU, a master's in psychology. My undergrad is in economics with minor in art history from University of Pennsylvania. The reason why I got into DBT was because I was really interested in how the practice blends helping people clarify their values and then figure out how their transactions can make those values happen. And that dynamic of development and growth was very appealing to me. And when the Linehan Institute had their first independent practitioner training, I jumped right on it. And that's really how I got my intensive training. And I've been working in New York City helping university students, emerging adults, and professionals ever since.
Many people who have heard about DBT have heard about it in the context of helping people who are struggling with borderline. But of course, that's not all DBT can help with. Who is DBT for?
Well, that's a great question. I think it comes back from the history of DBT, originally developed by Dr. Marsha Linehan to help people with borderline personality disorders who had suicidal tendencies and self-injury. And I think it grew to become a practice of cultivating one's wisdom and one's ability to live mindfully, to build something that she called a life worth living, which I think gives hope to people in tremendous despair. I found that this can be shifted to a term that I coined as a life of worth, especially for the population I'm working with, because worth goes beyond money. It includes the domains of your school, your work, your career, your finance, your family, friends, and social relations, your hobbies, your interests, your physical health, your spiritual, your personal development. And you want to be able to reduce non-effective, non-life-affirming behaviors. And this treatment helps people who need skills in this. It related to what Dr. Linehan called the biosocial model, where we have very highly sensitive people who have biological predispositions towards sensitivity, towards emotional sensitivity. And they also might have a social invalidating environment where they got mixed messages about what behaviors got what rewards. When you mix those two together, the highly sensitive person in this biosocial model has difficulty with emotion regulation, knowing how to tolerate stress, and build good relationships. And so I found that, especially in New York City, there are a lot of people who have these issues. So that's one of the ways that I've been taking it past the original BPD experience.
So there are some elements of mindfulness that are incorporated into DBT.
Sure. So what happens is, as a therapist, you're looking to understand the person and have that person understand himself better and give them a toolkit to be effective across all areas of life. And that comes about in teaching them mindfulness, which is a way of cultivating one's wisdom. That comes from, you know, perhaps a meditative internal practice, and also a way of observing the world around you in a non-judgmental way and describing it so accurately that you can participate it fully and, you know, learn what it is you like and what it is you don't like, and what would be a good strategy to use in a situation. And those strategies come from things like how you tolerate stress, which is the distress tolerance idea, that when you can't problem solve in the moment, you have some other options. You could tolerate stress, you could regulate your emotions, or you can stay miserable, as Dr. Linehan talks about. And staying miserable is a choice. And once that seems as a choice, you can work on other options. A lot of people in this population I'm talking about are really good problem solvers, but when they can't solve the problem, they go immediately to staying miserable. And that's where distress tolerance is helpful, where you can learn what it is you can do to cope in the moment to get you to the next stage. And it also comes about with thinking about radical acceptance, which is, how can I make it so I can really see the world or my position as it is right now and then know what I can do to make a difference or make a change or just wait it out? The same thing with emotion regulation. Many people don't see the breadth and the differentiation of their emotions. It's either all anger, all fear, or something like that. And what it's helpful to learn is, you know, your emotions are like all the colors in the Crayola box. And if you could really understand how you're feeling, you might choose a behavior that matches that better. Or you might be able to change how you feel based on understanding what are the functions of your emotions and how they work. In addition, there's interpersonal effectiveness, which is people need to know how to get what they want and how to say no to what they don't want and how to build good relationships, all while maintaining or keeping their self-respect in check. And these interpersonal decisions come through a clarification of objectives. And what that means is it's like the old economics thing, guns and butter. You can't have all guns or can't have all butter. Somewhere in between might be okay, but you can't have both at the same time. People need to know what is they want and specifically so that, you know, in a mindfully so they can actually get it. So this approach is an approach to teaching and learning and being. It's about discovery and development and dynamics and how you really handle ambiguity and ambivalence in a transactional analysis that brings forth hope, faith, optimism through action, through deed. And that's why I think it's really exciting.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And I just love what you said about helping people to understand the power of choice and how empowering it can be for folks to recognize that they may not have had as many choices to end up in the place that they are now, but they do have a choice as to whether or not they stay there. You know, to help them to be able to clarify their objectives and to figure out what it is that they want, I know sometimes can take some time and some effort and some patience. And so maybe we could talk a little bit more about that and how you help people to discover what it is that they want, and specifically, what are some of the goals of DBT?
This idea of clarifying your values and then moving them to goals, strategies, and tactics, recognizing you might not be able to get all the way up the mountain today. And a lot of people have a lot of impatience that I should have done it yesterday. And I'll give you an example. Like in psychiatry, if they gave the patient some medicine and said, "This will work in 2 to 3 weeks, let me know." What are you supposed to do for those 2 to 3 weeks while you're waiting each day that you pray the medicine would start to work?
Yeah.
This is a great moment when distress tolerance and mindfulness and interpersonal effectiveness and emotion regulation would be super duper helpful. Mm-hmm. Because you could just sit in your room waiting for the day to come, or you could go out in the world and say, like, what's happening here? How can I let it in some way that I find some joy, some connection to this earth, to these people that are around me, to make it better? And I think that, you know, this is how dialectics work, because, you know, according to Dr. Linehan, you might not have caused all your problems, but you have to solve them. And you might need your family to assist you. You're doing your best and you must do better. And I think that, you know, that's how the dialectics work between thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And the synthesis is not a mish of the two. It's kind of like a nuanced contextualization of of what's happening in the moment to know what's happening. I think how this works for clients and for practitioners is this idea of the balance between validation and change. Everyone needs the chance to know that there must be something that they're doing that is valid. It's not all bad.
Yeah.
And can I use that to see the whole person and highlight the positive, to be able to shed light on realistic strengths and motivate people to improve? And then find wherever that is, in whatever domain that is, and then use the highest form of learning, transfer, and transfer that learning across domains. I think it's very much an indeterministic system. Kind of like chess, you know, you don't know how to kill the king from the first move, yet you have to make a move. How do you know what to do? And you're trying to get people to be more apt to be in that middle stage where they feel in the game, understanding how the pieces are working towards the next moment. The same thing happens in art, you know, from the first stroke of a canvas, you never know what what the whole painting will be, and yet you try to get someone to engage so much in the moment that they get it to that middle stage where the energy is high and they've transferred their fear towards excitement that gets production. Having that going across all domains in someone's life, realizing that these domains are like pawns in a chess match, that you're advancing little by little, and you can see your evaluation of your life as the whole chess game, so it's not so much despair. Yet you'll be able to zoom in and localize how to help each chess piece as you need it. I think that's a very exciting part of being a DBT practitioner.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a great illustration to help folks understand how that progression occurs. You mentioned dialectic, and for those who missed it or may not be as familiar, can you talk a little bit more about that? What is a dialectic?
Sure. So I think a good way to think about it is you might have things on two poles, and those are competing strategies or competing things. Like, for example, I don't know if you like cold water or hot tea. Those might be two different sets of a dialectic. But if I put those together in the middle, like lukewarm tea, you probably wouldn't like that, right?
Right.
So that would be like the joining of the two. There must be a synthesis where, like, under these certain constraints, like I just ran a couple miles, I would really like some cold water. Under these other constraints, like it's kind of chilly in the morning, and it's going to be fall or something, I know I need a nice, you know, warm cup of tea. Another one, as I said, like you're doing your best and you must do better. If I only tell you that you're doing your best, there's no march towards change. If I tell you must do better, there's no understanding of validation. So in DBT, it's starting to have people get comfortable with this ambiguity, with this ambivalence, so that they can learn to understand the nuances of how the world works, because in their highly sensitive person biosocial model, it was a portrait of extremes where I'm asking you to come towards me and I'm pushing you away at the same time. And that is quite confusing because I don't know what to do with that. Like the little child who asked like his mom for a hug and then, you know, very kindly, and then she doesn't answer him, and then he starts screaming, and then the mom picks him up saying, "Oh, you're so loving," and then shuns him for screaming. What's his choice the next time? He'll probably go towards screaming sooner, you know? And this kind of like behavior over time gets very confusing. And you can see it getting played out, you know, as people get older with interpersonal conflicts or emotional regulation conflicts, etc. And these polarizing feelings can be dealt with through the DBT treatment. Also the polarizing behaviors, too.
Right. And as you talk about treatment and understanding that approach, what are some of those specific treatment modalities that we would expect to see with DBT?
Well, there's individual therapy where you are working on supporting their individual growth and dealing with behavioral chain analysis, which I can talk about a little bit later. There's also groups where you're learning skills, like the mindfulness, stress tolerance, and radical acceptance, interpersonal effectiveness, emotion regulation. You might do consultation teams where you're working with teams to figure out how to serve clients best. And there also could be coaching. You know, I think that it's more important for the people to be effective in the world than in my office. I mean, and I want to help them make that choice. And in the coaching model, they, you know, in individual therapy, you're learning skills as well as in groups. In the coaching model, someone might contact you because they're at a fork and they don't know what to do. And you can give them a little bit of help about how to use skills, and they might totally transform their life for the better.
Well, it's good for folks to understand the difference between that individual treatment and coaching. And I couldn't agree more with the importance of being able to be effective, you know, in the world outside of the office so that folks can actually, you know, apply what it is that they're learning. So that
I would say about, you know, in terms of how this relates to the university students or the emerging adults or the professionals that I work with. Because I found that the patient's self-harming behaviors may approach the physical self-injury or suicide, but as an expression of intense pain. And whatever it is valid for them. It's valid. Patients' pressures for success or the despair of lack of success may link to the features of the biosocial model. So they might have this dialectic where they feel really rich and really impoverished at the same time, not just because of money. And so whether it's for the university students where like now they've left home and there's no boundaries of home and you really see what the legacy of their academic pedigree gives you in the university. For emerging adults, it's people who might have, I don't believe emerging adults is an age band. I think it's a frame of mind. They might have had ways to, they might just feel stuck. Like, I don't know how to get out of this. I know I'm talented. And for the professionals, they might feel that someone promised them, maybe if they did something for their job and got some sort of their career, then they'd feel okay. And they might have achieved that, but they don't feel the pleasure or the happiness that they were promised. And for all of these people, what's really important is they got into some level in their life where they can't throw anything, they can't throw it away and start over. That's just not realistic. And, you know, validating that and radically accepting that is really important to then help them see their strengths and motivate them to improve and transfer learning across domains. It's like an uneven growth pattern. And if we can couch it in that way, there's a lot more power in the transformation.
As you look at those different treatment modalities, whether we're talking about individual or groups, or consultation, et cetera, what are some of the essential features that we would expect to be able to use?
Okay, so for groups or people even who do skills group training individually, you're learning a curriculum, which is like a graduate training in life skills, where you learn the specific skills of mindfulness, distress tolerance, interpersonal effectiveness, emotion regulation. And an individual therapy, you're really helping the person stitch those skills into their life. And also, see, these people have had these behavior patterns which made sense to them. It worked until it didn't. And then once you give them this skill set, they're going to realize that what they had been doing for a while actually no longer works. And they might have a lot of feelings about that in the current stage. And then when that happens, you have to help them and offer them alternatives. And I think that comes from behavioral chain analysis, where you understand the behavior and its function. And you document the behavior, like slowing down a movie to like frame by frame, so it can be changed without judgmental thinking. You see the behavior as antecedents, behavior and consequences of the actions, thoughts, and the feelings and the behaviors. And then as you analyze them, you can add these replacement strategies to change ongoing consequences. And that's a really important thing, because then they can then go out in the world. And I've always found this happen. It's like the same story in a different way. Someone will tell you, listen, I was going on and I always do it this way. But then I thought, maybe I could try it this other way that we were thinking about. And I have no reason to believe you or trust myself. But I just believe maybe I could try. And they do. And a lot of times it works, or it works just enough, just enough that they could be so excited that they have hope that they do it again. And that happens. It's happened time and again. It's such an amazing moment. It's a leap of faith, a return to trusting in themselves and optimism that they can make good things happen. And, I think that's a really exciting part of this process. So then the coaching process would just be outside of individual therapy when they need some coaching to keep it going. But sometimes just that idea that it could happen, that could be coaching. I was going to call you, but then I remembered I could do this. And then it happened. Like, so I think it's a gradual release program, a support system that helps people realize that they're not alone and that they have options. And for me, being increasing the perception of options will lower the depression, will increase hope, and help turn anxiety towards excitement and calibrate it towards whatever the task is instead of an overextension of anxiety.
Yeah, well, there's certainly great power in those replacement strategies and being able to see people having increased options and seeing, you know, that correlation where the depression does decrease. And we know that this is not exclusive to just one particular demographic. When we're talking about sensitive people, you know, who are we referring to?
When I've worked with educators, I've seen like sometimes they can keep it really good with their children at the day of school, but once the school day is over, they don't have enough energy to continue on through other areas of their life. Sometimes artists only feel alive on stage or when showing their work. Sometimes university students, and unless they're getting all the A pluses, then they don't feel alive. Sometimes emerging adults, when they can't understand that a high school commencement or a university commencement means commencer, to begin, they have trouble thinking about why are they on a nonlinear path, even though it might be right for them. Some professionals, they work so hard to become professionals that they forgot to work on other areas of their lives. And I think over time, denying yourself those realities that you have needs and need to tend to your skill set across domains can come back to you if you're a sensitive person. And for other people who are highly sensitive or who had a experience growing up over time where the nurture helped them tolerate the ambiguity and the ambivalence, then they just know these things. And I find that when I'm working with the population that I do, that's a big part of radical acceptance. How come all these other people get it and I don't? Okay, let's figure that out, and then let's give you the skills so you can. And that's what I think is really a big power, when they can feel that the joy that's in them that might have been held back can show, when they can express their love or their talents in new ways, when they can regain their wisdom or their curiosity for anything novel. Hey, guess what? I decided to make a painting this week. I never did that since I was in fifth grade, but it's really important to me. Anytime you can increase space, mental space, and help them see the world in a clearer, more mindful, and more wise way, and help them learn enough so that they can self-correct when they're out in the world, then you've done a good job. And I think that's really, really powerful. And I've seen a lot of people, after working with me or doing treatment, they've been so much more impactful because they're really using their emotions, their reason, their wisdom to be better parents, to be better doctors or artists, or they'll even try things they never thought they could do. So calibrating yourself to reality gives you a lot of power to hope and dream, and then linking that to specific transactions so you can make good things happen keeps it not from being only in your mind. And for me, that's really important.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So that they can actually apply it makes all the difference in the world. And as we're talking about helping them to be able to make this type of progress so that they can not only overcome the current struggle that they are experiencing, but to be able to perform at this higher level that you're describing, what specific skills are they being taught with DBT?
First of all, they have to be able to observe what's going on. And, all of your information in your brain comes from your senses. If you aren't taking things in accurately through your senses, everything is slightly off kilter. So I think the beginning is to do that, and then to describe it factually. And it was great because I learned these things from, I was in art school for 2 years. I learned from my art instructor. I learned from great teachers and education, that really being able to see and then editing out all the noise gives you the possibility to foster change within yourself and other people. And that allows you to participate more fully because you don't have to be a wallflower in the high school dance. You could actually listen to the music and see how it moves you. And doing that in a non-judgmental way, factually, not persecutory, is important. And then taking that to be effective and do one thing in the moment. Multitasking doesn't really work. You know, just ask a kid whose parent is looking at their Facebook page. They just want to spend time with their parent. So that's really important, to be able to find the balance of your emotions and your reason, to find your wisdom, this intuitive knowing that also allows you to use all talents that you have. And then in terms of distress tolerance, can you find things that can make you feel so engrossed that you forget about what was bothering you? Do you know what those are? Can you find them easily? Does anyone else know what they are? That's things about distress tolerance. And also radical acceptance. Avoiding is really important. In terms of emotion regulation, people need to know that their emotions don't go 0 to 60 in 0.3 seconds. There are gates in all different aspects of emotion regulation that you can actively use your wise mind to be able to shift how you feel to get rid of negative ones and cultivate happiness. And then to personal effectiveness, people need to know how to clarify their objectives and then be able to, you know, use these DBT skills to get what they want while preserving relationships and self-respect in some mix. But the best part about this, it's the same thing with education. You know, education lacks medicine's prescriptive ability to tell someone exactly what to do in every moment, every time. And that's what the best part about DBT is, because you want to have the structure of these skill sets in place with the flexibility to mindfully understand the context and then select which one will work best for you. Just like the chess player. Different chess players would look at different moves and make different moves based on their own personal valuations. The same thing in life. The more we can empower people to do that, the more self-determination they have to feel autonomous, competent, and related, and then, you know, efficacious. And I think that working on that self-determination way with specific skill sets and the empowerment to make those choices can allow people of all different backgrounds to be even better. I really think that's like where the future of DBT is going, or should go, because have you ever met someone who said they're already as effective as they want to be? Yeah, or they could be? Probably not.
Right.
If they did, they need the help the most. Mm-hmm. But, I think that, even attaching that to higher order thinking or comparing, contributing, how do we look around and say, like, okay, compared to a lot of people, I'm doing okay. My problems might be big for me, but maybe other people might have it bigger. And I think that's important too, like with the world. So what would we do how do we make our internal life as good as possible, our familial life, our professional life, as our ways of helping make change in the world that's tangible change? And I think that bringing some of these skills to our children as they grow is really important too, because, you know, why not? You know, why not teach them to be mindful, and why not teach them how to meditate and how to breathe and how to be kind to people? So I think that shifting it back to away from I've been hurt, let me change, to how do I cultivate my wisdom and my ability to live mindfully, to build a life of worth across areas, all areas of life, seems to build a lot of authenticity and satisfaction. And listen, it's hard work, very hard work. And that's why you have to honor the people who come to see you for their trust, for letting them into your life. I've said that to clients. And I really appreciate that you're letting me into your life. I value that. I honor that. And I hold that. So I think that as a practitioner, you can speak and you can be using these strategies. And that's what's so exciting, to work in this modality and then do your best to live it and know that you're doing the best you can. And you must do better yourself. And that's, I think that's, doesn't seem as judgmental or threatening, and yet you have to do better. And I think that's a really good growth model.
Oh, absolutely. And to hear that and understand, you know, the role of the therapist as an educator and as an encourager, what are some of the other roles of a therapist who uses DBT?
Well, I think it's really fun because you get to do so many different things. You get to be a scientist. You are trying to like track behavior and understand how to shift things on a very experiential way. And helping people become that scientist for themselves supports the practitioner's mindfulness and also the mindfulness for the client. Also, scholar. Trying to find ways to see DBT in the world and bring that to the clients so that they see that it's not just this mystery that we get from this treatment or someone's office or something. But if you look around, it's really there, which speaks to the Zen and Western practices coming together by Dr. Linehan to make this treatment. Also, you're also like a social entrepreneur, because there could be some exciting case management things to do to help jumpstart people who have a lot of talents, but they just can't see it at that moment. You're also an artist, because you're taking, maybe you're like a curator, taking great artwork from visual art and poems and songs and media of all types to really use art as a motivating factor to help people find whatever relative truth there is. You're also a cheerleader because they need to redevelop their positive self-talk, and you might become the interject for the beginning. I said to people times that you might hear my voice in the beginning, but then you'll hear somewhat like mine and yours, and then you'll only hear yours. And that's a really powerful moment. You know, you're also this coach who they're asking really interesting questions. And it's, you know, because of the work that I do, it's also about, you know, university life. It's also about their professional life. What are they going to do? How do they support this experience? You also might give them parental coaching. And you're also this information architect, because these mindfulness, this DBT skills are coming as information that has to be understood and then internalized by yourself and the client. And that educational piece is also about helping them do cognitive and emotional restructuring. And so I think thinking how this information comes in, not only from, you know, mindfulness of the observation, but also of the materials and seeing their overlap to get this transfer of learning is another piece. So it's a very exciting thing because all these roles, I love them because they come a lot from my own background. But it's a really great way to have a wide range of tools to help people at very different stages. And then all those stages could have different sub-stages, and you never know which part you need. So you're actively hunting for ways of improving yourself. And I think that's a really cool part about being a DBT practitioner.
Well, it's just great to be able to use these variety of tools as we're talking about, you know, positive self-talk, this concept of replacement and cognitive restructuring, mindfulness. And it really is a strength-based approach, isn't it?
Yes. I think coming from the strengths really allows the validation to happen, because for a lot of reasons that might not be factually accurate, but they feel accurate, these highly sensitive people have a lot of shame and a lot of guilt, even though it might not have been because of them. And we have to deal with that. And I think the first way to deal with that is to find out, do you know what your strengths are? And then when I always ask people about that, some of them are shocked. Some of them are really shocked with the next question I always ask them. What are your hopes and dreams? And some people tell you. Other people like, I don't know. And the answer to the next question is, cool, let's find out together. I think even that way starts validating the fact that you can build a good life, a really good one. It takes effort. You have to do the work. We're looking for repetitive feedback loops that people might think are circles, but they're really spirals upwards. And I think it really comes from the strengths. And once that happens, when you do the behavioral chain analysis, you might get more honesty with every, you know, radical honesty about what really is happening. And you can really use a non-judgmental approach to why these behaviors are functional or are not functional by really just doing pros and cons. I think that's really important to notice, because I think shame comes from a fear of being judged. And with the strength-based approach, then you can take that away, and I think change happens easier that way.
Well, you've mentioned this importance of self-acceptance, and I know that there are many people who struggle with that, and DBT is really a radical approach to helping people reach this goal, isn't it?
Yeah, but once again, I really think it happens in terms of self-acceptance on this clarifying values to transactions piece, because you can ask people, what's your power song? Well, I have no idea. I listen to music all the time. I don't know what power song is. Okay, then you ask them, like, let's help you find it, or why don't, let's, you know, you can find it. And then it becomes, what power song for when? And I think that that piece builds that self-determination. Oh, you mean I can decide for myself what I like and when I get to decide what I want? And I think in every population that I work with, that is often the major crux of self-concept is self-determination. And what's important is the ability to have the specific transactions, specific behaviors that help them feel what it is that they like. But they have to be mindfully able to observe what it is as it is in that moment. And I think that's how you build subconcept.
Well, how does the practice relate to the populations that you specifically work with?
Well, I think that, you know, what we've talked about is self-determination. And in the university life, if you get to a moment where you go as freshman year or sophomore year and you forget that life's a marathon and you only had room for a sprint, you're going to need my help, or you need help of DBT, because you might have such a spare about success that it is not happening for you and everyone gets it so easy. It might be these underlying skills that you're lacking, compounded with academic readiness, that could work together to create a mental illness situation where you might need treatment. And that's why, how it could be helpful. For emerging adults, this nonlinear path is very hard to swallow for a lot of people. It could be as hard to swallow for people who are of privilege. It could be hard to swallow for people who like things that their cohorts don't like. Happens a lot in New York City. And they need to be able to handle that despair in a radical acceptance way, to be able to make choices throughout their days that could lead to the development of clarifying values and goals and strategies and tactics, however that makes sense for them. And for professionals, I think if they're being asked to devote so much of their time for professional experiences and the people can't handle all that at once, but they're afraid to show that, they might need to be able to learn these skills to keep all of these activities going as best they can while they maintain their home life, their work life, and their social life. And I think that since a lot of the skill set can be used as soon as you gain it, that you can be able to begin to make improvements, you know, as soon as you get the information. And this is not saying take on your hardest challenge in the first moment, but just start to see if you can notice some seeds of growth. So for all these populations, I don't think a complete reboot, whatever that means, is actually helpful or necessary, because it misses all the little pieces of their lives that are so interesting that they might have forgotten, or that their successes that can be transferred to the areas where they find less success. And then dealing with the concepts of ambiguity and ambivalence is probably the most challenging for this these populations. But it's so necessary, because we live in a world that we don't know what's going to happen. And I think this is particularly how important these DBT skills and this DBT way of thinking can be helpful for this population in building the life that they want across all domains.
Yeah. And knowing that we all live in that same world, I know that it can be beneficial for all of us as well. And understanding that nonlinear path can be less predictable, and it does take patience. And as we start to come to a close, maybe we could end on a high note. And you know, so much of what you shared is so encouraging and really conveys a message of optimism. Why would you say that this work is so important and inspirational?
We never know the client, the patient, the practitioner. No one knows how the work will turn out. No one knows what the painting will look like at the end. And I've often find it's even more amazing than I would have thought. And I'm so happy about it, because this is a nonlinear experience. And this is people interacting with their internal development with the world to try to make something positive happen. And that restoration is really important, because they're building a life worth living, but it impacts so many other people. And I think that's why I'm really excited to work with this population, all these populations. University students, they'll make the choices for the next generation. They'll have a lot of impact, and they have so much foundation that can be used to build something positive. Emerging adults who see them off the beaten path, that's where a lot of creativity happens. And professionals, they're building the foundations in the current world for the next generation, and the reward that they have should come beyond money, but be a life that they feel powerful and supportive and also able to be sensitive and loving. And I think it comes down to how to make impact. And I find that this work helps you make impact to, you know, a lot of people. There's something, if you save a life, you save the world. Some people are able to make more and more impact on more and more and more and more people just by getting the tools. And I think it's important that a lot of times with the populations that I work with, when you explain something to them and you explain it in this non-judgmental way, they can accept that they didn't get it before. And then they can do something so beautiful for the world that the whole world benefits, and they might not have known about that person's inner pain. And for me, that's the best part of transformation, because you're taking what might have been terrible and turning it into the best beauty that can have such a chance to make the world better.
Yeah, well, I can't think of anything more important than that. And I'm hoping that we have inspired some of our listeners to join in that effort. But before we close, I'd like to ask you if there's anything that you'd like to share that we haven't discussed.
I just think the work you do is really important, and hopefully this podcast will help inspire people and the others that follow to feel good about the work they do and continue to do good work to help others.
Well, Dr. Matthew Mandelbaum, thank you so much for being my guest today on Psych Sessions.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And everyone, you can learn more about Dr. Mandelbaum by visiting his website at www.dbt.solutions. It's been my pleasure to bring you Psych Sessions. Take care, everybody.